Hello and welcome, listeners of the Artistic Foodies, to another bonus episode. In this bonus episode, we sit down with Zaki Hassan. Part of this interview is in our Star Wars episode, and here we present to you the full interview. Hope you enjoy. And as always, you can check out more episodes on Spotify or wherever else you found this podcast.
Our guest today is Zaki Hassan, who was born and raised in Chicago. He spent some time in Saudi Arabia before settling in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he's a well-known film reviewer and critic here in the Bay Area. He's part of the San Francisco Films Critic Circle. And he writes reviews for films in the San Francisco Chronicle, Huffington Post, Fandor, and he has his own podcast, the Movie Film Podcast, which I have listened to for a long time and great reviews on there. And he's part of this book that he was the author of called Geek Wisdom, The Sacred Teachings of Nerd Culture, which is a great title. So Zaki, thank you again for being on the show. And
thank you.
Appreciate your time here. So one thing we wanted to talk about a little bit before we get into the Star Wars aspect of this episode is tell us a little bit about your background. You know, you studied film in Chicago, and I know you started out as a filmmaker with you had your own production company, Mr. Boyd Productions. And tell us a little bit about that and the process of studying film, and you know, what were some of your influences as a student, and How did you develop to where you are now?
Well, first of all, thank you again for inviting me on. Yeah, I you know, I've been very fortunate in that I've been a media professional for 25 years at this point. I mean, right out of high school, I was able to get a job at a community newspaper when I was in community college, and so I got firsthand experience with film criticism. And from there, that made me want to pursue an education in film production with an eye towards, if not seeking, you know, a profession making films, being better equipped to critique them. So I went to Columbia College in Chicago, which is the largest film school in the Midwest. And, you know, I got a real firsthand account of the work that goes into getting something made. And that was really enlightening for me. You know, I'm somebody who I like your big blockbuster films, but I also like smaller independent movies. So seeing the entirety of the production process from concept to completion and having to carry productions through, that was really helpful in terms of expanding my own experience. And, you know, ever since then, I've worked on smaller productions with my partners, and you know, the guys I work with. You know, you alluded to it with Mr. Boyd Productions. I mean, they've gone on to work regularly in the industry. You know, my one colleague, Sean Coyle, he's an executive producer at Disney. He produces a show there called Puppy Dog Pals. My other partner, Brian Hall, is a writer for various animated shows. He worked on Bob's Burgers. You know, so for me, it's been great to see their, professional lives extend in that direction. And I've been very fortunate from my end in the Bay Area, where I've been able to expand my reach as a writer, which is something I always enjoy. You know, I like being a journalist. I like being a media critic. That's very much where my interests have gone towards. So I'm grateful for having had the whole spectrum of experience.
That's great. And just a little background, me and Zaki worked a little bit in the past on a project, which is the world famous, the Muslim Roundtable television show back in the early 2000s. And
amazing. Almost 20 years. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can't believe how long ago.
Amazing.
2003, 2004.
I should mention here. I connected with Irfan before I even moved out to the Bay Area. I don't know if you remember this, but I had messaged you. I was like, hey, I see the stuff you're doing. And so literally the first week I was in the Bay Area, I met with you at the old SBIA building in downtown San Jose. Yeah, week one.
I remember that. And then we had a lot of good projects that we together, and we even got the chance to interview this world famous actor Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm sure you remember that. He was working on a film. You know, the film wasn't actually that good, but it was just
all right.
It was Hidalgo. Yeah,
Hidalgo. That's okay.
But we were just excited just to meet him. You know, like right from the Lord of the Rings and all that stuff. So it was a pretty exciting time. You did a lot of great work in terms of giving back to the community and educating film and media. So we appreciate that. So let's get into a little bit about the Star Wars films. Did it have any influence on you as a student or when you were studying film?
Well, I think above and beyond as a student, I think Star Wars has just sort of, it's impossible for me to separate Star Wars from my life and wonder who I am as a person. I mean, I've been a Star Wars fan since the cradle. I always say this, I was born in 79. Just talking about Star Wars in my own life, I above and beyond its impact on me as a film student or as a media professional, I mean, I can't separate Star Wars from my life going all the way back to when I was a little kid. I was born a Star Wars fan because, I was born in 79. The film came out in 77. My brother is 5 years older than me. So, it's kind of like, my first words were Mama, Baba, Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader. That was it. I remember very distinctly, my brother got like Empire Strikes Back action figures for his, whatever his sixth birthday, whatever it was. And, him going to school and me just kind of mangling his toys and whatnot. So, in 1997, the films will be released for the 20th anniversary. And, from then to now, Star Wars has always been sort of part of the pop culture. But we forget that there was a period there from like 85 to 95 where Star Wars was just like gone. Like it was not part of the cultural conversation. I mean, they'd started coming out novels again in the early 90s, but it was, now it's just ubiquitous. It wasn't that way. So for me, above and beyond as like a film student, it was just always a part of my life, And so for me, like now as a parent, one of the joys of being a parent for me with all these kids is I get to experience it through them. And it totally changes my perception. I think that's why I'm just more easygoing when it comes to, I see people argue online about, is this canon and does that count or whatever? And for me, it's all Star Wars. It's fun,
That's a very passionate conversation. People have lost friendships over that.
Very true. Very true.
So I was wondering essentially if you could tell us what order Star Wars came into your life. Did you watch it chronologically? You said you were born in 79. The first one came out in 77. Was it 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9 for you?
That's exactly right. Release order. Yeah. I mean, for me, Star Wars is always three movies with a beginning, middle, and end. So when those prequels came along, I went through my own sort of journey of acceptance with them because I was 99, right? So I was 19 when Phantom Menace came out, and I was pretty negative about it, just like most people my age, and so I always kind of, for me, it was like, well, there's the three Star Wars movies and then there's those other ones. That was always me. And truthfully, I mean, it took, going back to what I said earlier, it took watching them with my kids and realizing, like, man, they're not getting lost in all the nerdy stuff. They love Jar Jar Binks, and, right? So at that point, I had to be like, my Star Wars is always, like, I'll always plug into it in terms of those three movies. But that doesn't make anyone else's experience less valid, You got plenty of people who came in with the prequels, and that is their egress into this universe. And the same thing's going to happen with these new movies that everyone complains about. Like, it's this, you know, I say this all the time online, but I'm like, it's a big fridge. There's plenty of ice cream for everybody. Just because you don't like this flavor, it doesn't mean you can't like that flavor.
See, this is the unifying voice we need in America right now. I love your perspective on it because I was born in 91. My first Star Wars movie was Phantom Menace in 99. Nice. Okay. And I was living in Saudi at the time. I was living in Riyadh. And so it took a little bit of time for the movies to eventually get to where we could access it. So I still remember, you know, it was a DVD and we put it and watched it on the computer. And I must have been like 10 or 11 years old. And I mean, I was just, I love Jar Jar Binks. I thought he was the funniest thing in the world. And so sort of like coming back to it decades later and realizing all the hate that people had for him, I was just, I was very shocked and surprised to say the least.
What you're saying, that's what's so instructive about this is when what we tend to do, right, just as human beings, we define normal by us. We're like, this is me, this is my experience, this is what I like, therefore anybody else who has a different point of view is wrong, right?
Exactly.
And especially when it comes to pop culture, I'm always like, well, first of all, you can't like hate a movie. You can dislike it and just be like, well, I will never watch that again. But people are like, I hate that. It offends me. You know, I like the Delta Force offends me, right, as a Muslim. But I'm like, if you're a Star Wars fan, you just say, all right, well, watch the thing you like, you know. Just and you know, a couple of, this is relevant. You know, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to interview Ewan McGregor, who of course played Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I told him this story, which is, I think is so apt. You know, I had been reading a Star Wars storybook to my kids, and there was a picture of Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi, and my kid says, oh, that's, you know, he was probably like 5 or 6. He says, oh, that's Obi-Wan Kenobi. And then there was a picture of Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan Kenobi. He says, oh, that's old Obi-Wan Kenobi. Right? I thought that was interesting because my perspective, and I'm sure Irfan can relate to this, is, well, Alec Guinness is Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
And Ewan McGregor is young. He's young, Obi-Wan.
Exactly. That's right? Fascinating. That's really fast. And I feel like this, you know, you're talking about like this generational thing. Now when I look at 79, I know when the seventh movie came out, I got all dressed up. I had I had a Chewbacca onesie on that I bought from Target specifically for it. You know, went into the movie theater, didn't read anything about it until I watched it. And then I watched it. And except for a few little bit of nostalgic moments, you know, I was caught up in the moment, but after leaving, I realized that I actually hated the movie.
This is Force Awakens we're talking about.
yeah exactly. Okay. The only force that was awakening in me was like, why did I just waste my time? Like that, they had a little bit of a nostalgic factor, but it was a recycled plot. And so now when I look at 789, I can kind of understand what sort of the generation before me feels like when they look at 1, 2, 3, when they look at Phantom Menace and they're like, oh, this is terrible. So,
and what I would say is wait 15 years and just see what the kids of today think about
it. Yeah. I mean, this is a great lesson. And I have a 4-month-old, she's 4 months old now. Nice. And, you know, I don't want her to have too much screen time. She's just a baby, except when we're all watching Star Wars. I don't care how old she is. That'll always be sort of safe space for her to watch. And even though I've been married almost 5 years, it took almost 5 years for my wife to finally agree to sit down with me and watch the Star Wars films. And I think the reason why is I was trying to introduce her to the films by watching 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6, which is the machete order.
Right, that's right.
Right. And so this is, you know, I feel like from the story perspective, this is maybe the best way. But, you know, just watching episode 4 and just something about watching a film from the 70s, she kind of got bored of it. So recently we started, we did 2, 3, 4, and then we're on 5 and 6 now. And with her, I'm going to be revisiting 7, 8, 9 with this conversation in mind, and just knowing that ultimately, I mean, this is for the future generations. Just it's all Star Wars, like you said, right? Yeah, even for my daughter, I don't know if you can see the little video, but I got this little baby Yoda, little crochet thing, you know. So you know that's what it's all about. What order did you introduce your kids to the films in?
So we watched the original trilogy And then the prequel trilogy. And you know, at least my oldest ones, you know, the timing kind of worked where, you know, they got into Star Wars in like 2012, 2013, thereabouts. And then, you know, and then the sequel trilogy happened almost right away, you know? So for them, like it's Star Wars has just always been like a thing, like an ongoing thing in their life. It's never something that went away. But my feeling has been and remains, I mean, notwithstanding your wife's reaction, I feel like the original movie, Star Wars, as I call it, still is still the best introduction to the universe. But obviously, other people disagree, which is fine.
What do you think about Rogue One? Because I actually rewatched that recently, and I also was trying to show my kids that. They got bored until the end, you know, when it got a bit exciting. But technically that's like the beginning before.
Yeah, I feel like this is like my own sort of bias because I'm like, well, you got to start with Luke Skywalker. That's just how it is. But I feel like that film works better if you know the context in which it exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I certainly, I don't know. I mean, it's impossible for me to separate my own lived experience with it, but it seems like the Darth Vader scene at the end and all the little callbacks and things like, you know, having Peter Cushing in there, like that really only works if you've already seen episode 4.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
In my opinion. It works. Let me rephrase. It works probably better if you've seen episode. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting that no matter what the age group, no matter what the cultural background, you know, I mentioned that we were watching it in Saudi Arabia. My dad actually told me a story. He was born in 70. So when the movie finally made it to him, you know, he was born and raised in Nairobi, Kenya. There's a scene where I can't remember who, but one of the alien characters starts speaking in what sounds like gibberish, but is actually in Kikuyu, which is the second largest spoken language in Kenya.
Oh, wow.
And everyone went wild. I mean, like the Kenyans were crazy for that film just because of that 4-second line in Kikuyu. So, you know, regardless of age groups, regardless of cultural backgrounds and even gender, it's not like a chick flick or like a, you know, a bro film. Why do you think Star Wars has such a universal appeal?
I think what works in its favor is that it exists completely outside of, you know, our current milieu. You know, it's not the future. It's not Star Trek where it's like, oh, this is, and I love Star Trek, but oh, this is us, you know, 300 years from now. I think George Lucas very wisely started his franchise out by saying a long time ago, galaxy far, far away. He's cutting more than anything about our world. You know what I mean? This is a fantasy. It's a fairy tale. It's the equivalent of saying once upon a time, right? And so that allows it to be something that anyone in the world can buy into because it's not explicitly about, you know, an American worldview. It's not American imperialism, no pun intended. And if anything, you know, the central idea of a group of resistance fighters who are against fascism, well, that's something that anyone anywhere can relate to. You know, it's a basic good versus evil, and we're just talking about the original three movies. It's a very basic good versus evil story that it's whether you're a little kid or whether you're young at heart, you can buy into that. You know, you can project yourself onto Luke Skywalker. The idea that, oh, I have unfulfilled dreams. I want to make something of myself. I mean, who doesn't feel that? Who doesn't have that longing?
Right, absolutely. And you can't deny the charm of lightsabers either.
That's right. You know, I mean, it's especially that original film, right? It's essentially an old time story of knights, but instead of swords, you have light swords. Instead of dragons, you have Darth Vader. But what are you doing? You're rescuing a princess. I mean, it's this template, you know. It could just as easily tell the same story about King Arthur, and it would still work.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good segue to get into sort of the inspirations. I know that Joseph Campbell worked as a consultant on this film, and he sort of really broke down the hero's journey. You know, he studied all these different stories and narratives and says, okay, so basically your basic story is this, right? It's the call to action, the threshold, you have a mentor, you know, you have this basic story arc. And I think, you know, when I think of the few films that follow it almost to a T, you know, something like The Matrix is a great example. But Star Wars, because he actually worked directly on it, you have all these archetypes. And the thing about archetypes is you see them in your own life. You see them in your own story. So in many ways, like Star Wars, if you're picking up this hero's journey, you can sort of see yourself in it and different characters from your life as well. So I know Campbell was a heavy influence. I'm curious to sort of break down the context of that time with you a little bit. So, you know, it came out in 77, production started, I think, in 75. And what was going on in the Bay Area at this time? You know, George Lucas was in the Bay Area, of course. So what was going on in the Bay Area in the late 60s, early 70s? And what influences do you think that that had on the original Star Wars film?
Well, I think above and beyond, you know, the specific Bay Area context, you look at the socio-historical context, there was obviously we were in the midst of the Vietnam War. We had just come out of the Nixon era where the American public, to a large extent, lost faith in the idea of a president being, you know, a benevolent force, you know, looking out for everybody. So there was a deep well of cynicism that came up as a result, not only of the Vietnam War, but also the breakdown of the traditional family. Obviously, drug culture became much more common. You know, the sort of traditional, if you will, Leave It to Beaver values were kind of breaking down. And so what George Lucas came to reflect by virtue of the fact that he came up in the Bay Area film community, having grown up in Modesto, you know, he had been hanging out with Francis Coppola, who of course did The Godfather. And so, you know, his own sensibilities were much more cynical, right? I mean, his very first film was THX 1138, which is a very dark dystopian movie about a fascistic government. I mean, that, think about it. That's George Lucas's first film right out the chute. I mean, that was his student film.
Yeah.
And he turned it into a feature. So that's like where his head was at. And it was so dark and so, you know, in his own head, that the movie, the theatrical version, which was, by the way, the first release of American Zoetrope, which was Francis Coppola's company, I mean, it tanked. The studio saw it and they were like, give us our money back. Like, they're like, we paid you to make this, pay up, you know, and because they knew they were going to take a bath on it. And they were right. I mean, I think it's a fascinating movie. It's not a crowd pleaser by any sense, but I think you're gonna have a lot of people like, ooh, George Lucas's first sci-fi movie. Let's check this out. And they're gonna watch it and be like, you know, hey, come on, Johnny, Janie, let's get the family together and watch George Lucas's first Star Wars inspiration. And it's just super dark, right? So that's where his storytelling was at. And I think honestly, what he realized was he realized in a weird way what Rod Serling realized with the Twilight Zone, which was like anything he wanted to do as far as a cultural critique and social commentary, he had to disguise it with about 8 layers of sci-fi trappings. And that's what Star Wars is, right? So it's a reflection of his own experience. It's a reflection of American experience. And I mean, obviously, being a Bay Area resident, I think we all would like to believe that you know, his own experience here, which, you know, there was just a bit more sort of, you know, open-minded thinking, I think, in terms of viewing the world and spirituality and things like that. But he took like 8 different elements and baked them all together into this mix that seems completely unique in and of itself. And yet you can see all the different influences that he brought into it, from Campbell to Coppola. It's all in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I agree about THX-1138. It's not a crowd pleaser. I'll also go as far to say it's not a family film, which I learned after trying to watch it with my family. So, you know, I got all my siblings together. I think 7 or 8 of us are sitting down. I'm like, I always watch movies they want to watch and just sort of like, you know, kind of bores me to sleep sometimes. But I said, okay, tonight we're going to watch a film I really, really want to watch, THX-1138. You guys like Star Wars, right? Well, it's his first film. And we watched it and we went all the way through. And the reaction they had was pretty much, I'm sure, the exact reaction the studio had. It's like, can you give me my life back like the last few hours?
Give me my time back.
why did you put us through it? Meanwhile, I'm sitting there like taking notes. So, you know, I think that, so there's two things that are really fascinating about THX I want to touch upon. One is, again, given the context of the time, you know, counterculture, Bay Area, anti-war, the psychedelic movement is happening. And there's a lot of this exposure and movement towards Eastern traditions and Eastern religions. Among this milieu of like Buddhism and Hinduism and all of that, you find, interestingly enough, you find Sufism, which I would say in this context is separate from saying that Islam was present there, because they were drawn to sort of Sufi poetry and Sufi stories and so on and so forth. So, you know, I wonder if you've sort of thought about, and if you could sort of share some reflections on, you know, how much of that made it into the Star Wars films. And, you know, of course, except for talking about the M count, we're not even going to talk about the M count sort of blood test aspect of this spirituality. What do you have to say about the spirituality of Star Wars, and what do you think the influences were?
I think the influences that you listed, I think they're all there. I think Lucas, and you know, you talk about sort of, it's like Sufism minus the Islam aspect. I mean, that's, yeah, it's sort of like an agnostic Sufism, you know. That a lot of these cats were into. I think when you look at how the Force is described, right, it's an energy field that surrounds us, it binds us, it's generated by life. I think that's what Yoda says, right? It's like a catch as catch can kind of spiritual view, right? It's like spirituality without explicitly having to lock yourself in to a specific deity or anything like that. And so, I mean, again, the guy was smart. He figured out, here's a thing that like everybody, no matter which faith system they ascribe to, they can plug into, right? Regardless of whether you're Christian, Buddhist, you name it, you can hear about the Force and be like, yeah, I get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like the description of the Force itself is a little bit Taoist in nature as well. You know, sort of almost taking this agnostic perspective, like you said. So I'm really curious to know if you are. So, in my research, I came upon this little nugget, which I think is fascinating. Are you familiar with the Sufi group known as the Habibiyah that sort of came up in the Bay Area in the late 60s, early 70s?
Only very vaguely.
What? So I'd like to know what you know about them, and then I'll sprinkle a little story in here.
I'm fairly certain whatever you know is more than what I do, so I'll seed the ground.
Okay, it's absolutely fascinating. So, it all starts with the Floating Lotus Magic Opera Company in the late 60s, which was a group of young artists who were very spiritually minded. This was an opera company that was led by an artist and poet named Daniel Moore. And the subject of their plays it was all sacred theater. And it would always be pulling from, you know, a little bit of Tibetan Buddhism, a little bit of Hinduism, you know, sprinkle some Zoroastrianism in there. But still, you know, Hafiz was there, Rumi was there. And so one day, this man by the name of Ian Dallas he's originally from Scotland. He himself had been drawn to Islam and to Sufism. And in fact, he's the one, it's been told, who gave Eric Clapton a copy of Majnun and Layla, And Eric Clapton wrote the song Layla about his own sort of unrequited love.
Wow.
So Ian Dallas, he finds out about the Floating Lotus Magic Opera Company, Sacred Theater. He says, I'm really into it. I think he found out about it from a Rolling Stone article. So he flies over to Berkeley, gets picked up in this sort of car that was very famous because the seats had been taken out and there were toadstools instead that people would be sitting on. It was all trippy, psychedelic, you know, like sort of grass covering it. And from that moment, Ian Dallas started to work his magic and essentially drew Daniel Moore and that sort of cohort of artists towards Islam. You can actually get into this, the story. Hakeem Archuleta talks about the story in a separate podcast, but they all took Islam in a cafe. They went and did sort of the ablution in the cafe bathroom in Berkeley in 1969. And then the next year, they all went to Morocco to see the Sheikh Ibn al-Habib and formally become Muslim and become Sufi. At this time... Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really interesting because this sort of cohort goes on to shape what is essentially Western Islam. You know, you think about Zaytuna College, you think about Talif Collective, all these sort of modern Western Islamic organizations and philosophies originate from this original group. Sheikh Hamza Yusuf was, you know, he was sort of inspired and a part of this group for a little while. So Daniel Moore ends up becoming Abdul Hai Moore, one of the most, he was named one of the most influential Muslims and so on. So the reason why I say all this, and we can go on so many tangents, very fascinating stuff. They were known as the Habibiyya. In 1971, after they performed Hajj in January, February, they came back to the Bay Area. And Ian Dallas, who at this point in time became known as Sheikh Abdul Qadir, a Sufi, he was fundraising for his second book, which is called Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And at this time, he was sending sort of his disciples at the time, which was the Habibiyya group, out to fundraise. And at this point, they had all seen THX 1138 and they loved it. And so, you know, they were under the impression and Sheikh Abdul Qadir was under the impression that, you know what, this George Lucas guy, he gets it. He sees through the veils. I think he's totally onto this. He would love the Sufi stuff. Go and talk to him and see if you can raise some funds. So he sent a delegation. It was Daniel Abdul Hai Moore and Abdulaziz Redpath, both of whom are unfortunately no longer with us. May Allah have mercy on them both. They went to go and talk to George Lucas and they talked about Sufism and they talked about Islam and they talked about God and they talked and talked and talked. And to me, it's undeniable when I look at pictures of this group in Morocco and I look at pictures of the Jedi Knights, there's no possibility that there's a coincidence. The robes are exactly the same. The look is exactly the same. Right. So, you know, I don't know how much of the force and the spirituality is directly inferenced from them because there was a milieu of stuff going on. But this was just a very interesting thing. And I was able to get at least a secondhand account of someone who heard the story directly from Daniel Abdul Hai Moore while he was still alive.
That's amazing.
It's one of my favorite stories. So now when I look at the Jedi Knights, I'm like, yeah, that's Moroccan Sufism right there.
Crazy stuff, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit of the Kurosawa films as well? I know George Lucas has sort of gone on record to say that Kurosawa has influenced his films. Talk to us a little bit about Hidden Fortress. I think the main point to cover there is just the plot of the princess going sort of with these farmers and the parallel between that and, you know, the princess being transported by these droids.
Yeah, I think more than anything, you know, there's above and beyond the narrative tropes that Kurosawa used. Yeah, specifically in Hidden Fortress, I think in a broader sense, the simplicity, the moral simplicity of samurai films was something that Lucas really plugged in with. You know, he said many times, you know, the Jedi are essentially samurai, and the way in which Jedi are supposed to wield their lightsabers with both hands, that's meant to be the way you see samurai, you know. And he, in fact, you know, George Lucas did not direct, The Empire Strikes Back, right? So he was back in the States while Irvin Kershner was doing it. And when he saw the rushes of Darth Vader, he was very upset because Darth Vader is using his lightsaber one-handed. And he's like, no, it's supposed to be a one-handed thing. It's supposed to be like a samurai sword. Obviously, I think in context of the film, it's like, oh, it's fine, George, don't worry about it, you know? But I mean, that shows his intent. And when you look at Qui-Gon Jinn in The Phantom Menace, I mean, he's got his hair tied back. I mean, he's clearly a traditional Jedi. And in fact, you know, samurai movies are called Jedi movies, you know, Jedi Geki, that's the name of the genre. So it's all on Front Street, you know, everything he intended. I think there's even a movie called Qui-Gon, if I'm not mistaken, which is, you know, where Qui-Gon Jinn, his name came from. So
is that where the word Jedi comes from? Because the Sufis will say that's inspired by Al Jedi.
I think there's a lot of overlap there. I mean, that's kind of the nice thing. I can certainly see a scenario where Lucas heard this variation here, that variation there, kind of merges it together and it becomes its own new unique thing, you know?
I love that. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a lot of, you know, speaking of the language and words used, like there's, for example, my son, his name is Mustafa. And, you know, obviously in Arabic, that means the chosen one. And Darth Vader, he's lives on the planet Mustafar, right? It's pretty blatant there. And then there's the, in the Rogue One, there's the planet of Jeddah. It's a holy, the holy city. And so there's a lot of
and the filmmakers said that was by design. They used that name very specifically. Yeah
definitely. So. So there's a lot of elements of Islam and Arabic language and Muslims in the Star Wars. I think everybody who is Muslim can see that. And like you said, there's influences from a lot of different cultures and religions. And that's one reason why it has a universal appeal, because everybody has some connection to it, whether it's in their language or their culture or their religion. So that's one of the universal aspects of the Star Wars series.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've gone through most of the questions. I do have one sort of final point. This is maybe a little bit nerdy and technical, and I don't know if we're going to include it or not in the final product, but I just want to talk to you about it. So watching THX-1138, one thing that I noticed was the use of human voice in as sort of building the soundscape. And in that film, you know, there's not too much dialogue, and whatever dialogue there is, it just feels very stiff and wooden. And rewatching sort of Star Wars, you know, with my wife now, I realize that the script actually kind of sucks.
yeah.
You know, from the perspective, like you're delivering these lines, like the characters are saying exactly what they're saying. There's no creativity there. So, you know, what I thought was really interesting is sort of his use of voicescapes in THX-1138. And I'm noticing that in the Star Wars films as well, that's sort of how he sets the scenes. And I think the other point was in THX-1138, sort of the guard robots are using these long wooden sticks that have tasers at the end of them, and they make almost the same exact sounds. I'm wondering if those are sort of proto lightsabers that, you know, sort of went on to then, you know, carry on and become the lightsabers that they were in the Star Wars film. So, you know, I just love to know from your more technical filmmaker perspective, sort of what you think about Star Wars films in general, and sort of what sets them apart from other films.
Well, you know, from a technical point of view, I mean, you have to give it up for the fact that George Lucas looked at his limitations and refused to be boxed in by them, right? I mean, people give him a lot of grief for being more in love with the technology than the actors who are within the frame, and I think there's validity to that. I don't think he's necessarily an actor's director. I mean, that's a controversial thing to say, but You know, with every, I mean, you look at the original Star Wars, which feels very quaint today, right? In from a 2021 perspective, you're like, oh, look at, you know, it's very small scale, right? Mm-hmm. And yet there's so much that is in that movie. It was the first time that had ever been done in a movie like that, you know, a dogfight in space in that way. The very first shot, like we forget what a big deal just that opening shot was, where, you know, the rebel ship flies over camera and then this massive Star Destroyer from underneath. Like there had never been anything like that, you know, in that way. And so my point is, like, that's the genius of what George Lucas accomplished, is he broke the world and reinvented it. And after the fact, we're like, well, this is always how it's been. Like, how could it be any other way? You know, he fundamentally reset the compass, you know, and granted, he was building on what had already been done with 2001: A Space Odyssey, but you can't compare what 2001 did with what Star Wars did.
Absolutely.
You know, and so the same thing goes, like, even the prequels, which, from a technical point of view, to me, it's like, it's a coin toss. I mean, you look at like Jar Jar Binks now, 20 years later, and he looks like a first generation render. Like nowadays you would render it like 2-3 more times to get it right. You know, he looks slightly like, even when he's in the same physical space, he looks slightly removed from that space, you know, and you sort of, you have to squint a little bit, like, all right, well, that's 1999 effect. But when you think about it, I mean, that was the first time you had a main character throughout the film that was completely digital. Like, you had, like, a few years before that was Casper, but it's no comparison.
Right.
And now, I mean, think about it. If not for Jar Jar Binks, we don't have Thanos.
Oof.
Yeah, I mean, them's the facts.
That's a heavy statement. I want to hear more praise of the Phantom Menace. Keep it going.
and I say this as somebody who's like 50-50 on the Phantom Menace.
That's going to be the tagline for this episode. If not for Jar Jar Binks, we would not have Thanos. Wow.
I think it's just borne out, you know, because George Lucas did it, and, you know, some of it worked, some of it didn't, but somebody had to pave the road.
Yeah, the other thing, just to go back on the technology, which is one of the things that George Lucas pushed for, is that he made all these movie theaters become, you know, he started the digital projection, right? I believe he's the one who said, okay, this movie that's coming out, I think it was The Phantom Menace, is going to be majority digital, and you have to use this projector to show it, otherwise it's not going to work properly, right? So he kind of pushed it, and because he had the reputation of Star Wars behind him, all those theaters installed that. So he's like an innovator in terms of movie technology, and obviously special effects, and everybody is familiar with that. And even today, because I've kind of brainwashed my kids, they're still young, so they're only eight and four, to watch the original Star Wars, and even they are impressed with the effects of the original Star Wars movie. And you know, like you said about the big Imperial Star Destroyers coming in the beginning of the movie, it's like, you know, if you're watching it for the first time, if you're a kid, that's still like an amazing, amazing shot, right? So, and they made it with just like models and toys, but you can't tell that, right? It looks like a real thing.
Yeah.
So that's one of the amazing things about the movie, is that he pushed the limits of technology, and he made the whole industry follow him, and they have to catch up. And now because of that whole process, more and more technology has advanced in the movie industry.
Iconic. It was an iconic shot. So Zaki, one word answer. Phantom Menace, hate it or love it?
I can't give you a one word answer.
he's a film critic. He can't do that.
I'm gonna say
That's a good answer. That's an honest answer.
Here's what I will say. I've been on a journey with that movie from the time it came out. When it came out, I think like most longtime Star Wars fans, I was like, hey, it's good, you know? And I went from there to, I don't like it. And so I'm at a point now where I'm sort of like, I've been on the journey and now I've come home and I'm like, it's good. Like
that's fair. That's 100% fair. Star Wars in general, is it Luke Skywalker's film or is it Anakin Skywalker's film?
Do you mean the original, like episode four, you mean?
Star Wars to you, Star Wars this sort of like concept.
It is a story of a family. So to me, the comparison I would draw is, you know, it's like novels by James Michener, or even, you know, when you look at something like Roots, I mean, you're following, it's this universe, but your various characters move in and off of the stage.
Skywalker family.
I think Disney now calls these nine movies the Skywalker saga. I think that's a good way of sort of put, you know, you're able to sort of put these nine behind glass while still continuing the series. You know, I believe there's going to be an episode 10, 11, 12 at some point, but what you're able to see with these nine movies, warts and all, because, you know, some are better than others, but you see this journey with this family, which I think is really cool. When you go from Anakin to Ben Solo and anything in between, I think it's honestly, I'll tell you, and I'm confident history will bear me out. The more time passes, people really appreciate this saga of this family. I truly believe that. I think all the slings and arrows people shoot at either the prequels or the sequels, a lot of that stuff is going to fall aside once people say, once you separate out like the passion of the moment and just watch them as a nine part story.
Oh, just one last question. I know you got to go. The baby's calling you right now. Or is that a boss's baby?
Oh, that's the boss. They work from home life.
That's fine. That's fine. You got an extra couple minutes then. What do you think about The Mandalorian, which is, you know, nominated recently for Best TV Drama on Disney Plus, which I recently watched it. Personally, I thought it was an amazing show, and it was very, had elements of nostalgia, but also it was a brand new story, brand new characters, and I thought it was great. Just wanted to get your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I above and beyond the story and the setting, I really like that it is kind of this weekly series. I enjoy that aspect of it, of like you watch the episode and then you get to wait, and that wait is sort of baked into how you experience it. You know, without getting into spoilers, I mean, this past season that just ended, I mean, there were reveals in certain episodes that I feel like meant more because it wasn't a show that you binge watch, you know. I mean, the season finale obviously has a very big, cool thing that it shows. And I, you know, if this was like the Netflix model where you just drop 10 episodes and just get to it whenever, that the last episode wouldn't have meant as much, you know? And so to me, that's what's really cool is, I mean, it clearly exists in the Star Wars universe. It's not like cheap shot in Vancouver Star Wars. It's clearly like they put movie money into it. And it feels very consistent with the world that it exists, but it also shows how, you know, how they can expand beyond the Skywalker saga. And they do, you know, there's a lot of interesting places to go. I think if this is an indication of all, you know, because they got like just a bag full of new Star Wars things coming, right? Set in every time, like, oh, we got the future here, we got the past here, they're doing everything. If this is an indication of they're going to approach it, my God, I mean, Disney's going to be making bank for a long time to come, you know?
Yeah, and I also saw that one of the trailers for the Obi-Wan Kenobi show. I'm not sure if it was an official trailer or not, but it looked pretty good, you know? And then...
Yeah.
Boba Fett show coming in too.
Boba Fett, that's right. Yeah. It's really smart when you think about it, because what they're doing is they've got a bunch of shows set in the era between the prequel and the original films. They've got a bunch of shows set after, between, you know, Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens. They got a bunch of shows set before The Phantom Menace. You have all these Star Wars timelines that you can, and this goes to what I was saying earlier. It's like, all right, well, if you don't like this era, fine, just ignore it. You got all this stuff here you can watch, you know, fine. You don't like mint chocolate chip, there's cookies and cream over there for you. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you must like mint chocolate chip or you're not following the canon. It's all been that. I mean, that's it. Like, a part of me gets upset when seeing all this new stuff. I'm like, no, but the originals. But yeah. Honestly, I think you've changed my mind. I think you have a very unifying message. I think, you know, anyone who's hearing this podcast hopefully will change their mind if they were set in their old ways. I have to say, at the end of this, if there's only one takeaway for me, is it's that I'm very excited for my kids. You know, my daughter is 4 months old right now. She has a whole world ahead of her. If you look at my car, I mean, the floor mats are Darth Vader. On the back, it says baby on board, and it's a little baby Yoda. This is a world I'm bringing her into.
Well, and you know, I'll just say my daughter, she's four. And you know, she loves Rey and Kylo Ren. Yeah. That's her Star Wars. So wow. Just goes to show.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you very much, Zucky, for your time. We appreciate it.
And thank you.
We will. You want to mention your podcast that you're usually on, and
do your plug. Do your plug.
Yeah. Well. Thank you so much again for having me, and thank you for mentioning the show earlier. Yeah, it's the Movie Film Podcast, which we usually have 2 to 3 episodes a month. It's myself and my partner Brian Hall, and in addition to talking about new releases and Hollywood news and whatnot, we also do 1 to 2 commentary tracks a month for various films. And so, as it pertains to this conversation, we've done commentaries for episodes 1 through 7. Of the Star Wars films, where essentially we watch the movie and we talk through and, you know, point out various, you know, things, Easter eggs and behind the scenes stuff. Sometimes we workshop the story while we're watching, like, oh, maybe they could have done this instead, whatever. We have a lot of fun. I think they make for very good tracks. I have not listened to them, admittedly, but I hear good things. So I would love if people would check those out. Just go into the film podcast archives.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for coming on here. I had a lot of fun talking about my favorite topic with you. It's been an honor. Like I said, I've been following your work for a very long time. So to be able to talk to you about film is just, this has made my week.
No, thank you so much. I'm honored that you asked.